Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shadow Watchers by A.G. Mock. Narrated by Jeremy Carlyle Parker. Part 1. Alpha. 1. The End. Waking up, ready to reveal it all. His heartbeat throbbed behind his eyes, each pulse fueling the unbearable pain as a stream of blood poured from his temple. He wailed through lips cracked and swollen, a haunting sound that reverberated in piercing echoes through the woods. Now the thing coming at them loosed a cry of its own, every minor chord at once. The shriek set fire to the man's nerve endings, a thousand blistering pinpricks. "This can't be real," he lied to himself as the angel wrapped around him and crushing fear took hold. "This isn't real!" Folding into his shape as he lay in the frozen mud and stinging rain, the angel unfurled great wings like solidified light. They hammered the space above them, striking at a thing the man could not see and could not possibly understand. "This is just another one of your night terrors," his internal voice asserted. "A cruel mental torment, courtesy of your own sick mind." The self-reassurance was bold and resolute, but as powerless as it was untrue. Savoring the rising acid taste of the man's terror, the thing screamed again, a warbling, ear-splitting yowl. And though he could not see it, a terrible, deep vibration shuddered through the man, revealing to his mind's eye an ancient being so unhallowed it was beyond human comprehension. The last thing the man would see was the dying light in the angel's eyes as it held him even tighter, refusing to yield as their bodies were pummeled beneath the trees in the stinging rain. Again, and again, and again. With each blow, the demon squealed in pleasure, growing stronger in equal proportion to the angel's dimming light. When that golden rod was extinguished altogether, the beast roared as all became nothingness. Now the man's fear, his pain, the wet and cold confusion, all slipped away to an empty space. A safe space. All of it, that is, except one simple question. How did it find her? To this, the man's expiring mind had no answer, for it was impossible to comprehend what it even was, let alone a motive compelling its blistering, malignant hatred.
"Besides, none of this is real," his mind persisted, clinging to a facade of hope, the last vestiges of which had been all but snuffed out with the angel's light.
Still, the question floated there, taunting, until the synapses in his brain slowly fizzled, then stopped firing altogether. And so, this one all-encompassing question became his last thought. Dissolving into the ether, it floated away as he, too, became one with the void. That's how it happened. I don't mind admitting, I didn't understand any of it. At first. But I do now. Now I know what that thing was. I know how it found the woman he was hiding. I know what it was after. And most importantly, I know the only option we have left. Now, I'm finally ready to share it with you. All of it. But are you sure?
I mean, really sure. You're finally ready to hear it? Part 2. Nexus. 2. Hell's Kitchen. 16 years before the end. June 1995. Waking in sheets sodden with his own sweat, Riker Winslow had no idea it was the last morning of his life. Prematurely torn from an unfulfilling sleep, he kicked free of the twists and tangles binding him to the cold, damp mattress. As superficial as Riker's sleep had become after what happened last autumn, it still had managed to buoy him from at least some of the torments of his life, one in particular. But today, it no longer afforded that benefit. For here life was, smacking him straight in the face. His head was thick, the inside of his skull bristling with every move. Then came the serious pain, a marble that glowed like the tip of a blacksmith's iron inside his skull. Cradling his face with shaking hands, his brain chafed against what must surely be a lining woven from coarse wool. Yes, my love, the kind of lining that's so beautifully knit by cheap bourbon, his late wife had once chided, and Riker still chuckled at the joke to this very day. But laughing only made the emotional and physical pain worse, and he found himself focusing on nothing but the discomfort. And, of course, the angel. On the night it first appeared to him, Riker had thought it the component of a dream, a hallucination, perhaps even one of his lingering night terrors from childhood. After all, the slightest of change in one's physiology had the ability to greatly impact one's psychology. And Lord knows, his physiology was more than slightly changing these days. What was that wonderful Dickens quote again? Riker dedicated himself to remembering the answer as he ran his bare feet back and forth across the hardwood floor, grounding himself and doing his best to ignore the sensation of a rusty nail through his skull. He racked his memory to not only recall the quote, but to do so as accurately as possible. Intense concentration on anything but the pain was one of the few ways he'd learned to take back just some of the power it had over him. Slowly, the words surfaced, and Riker recited them in his mind. They were from Dickens's A Christmas Carol, dialogue spoken by Scrooge himself to one of his ghostly visitors, a proud declaration of his disbelief. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of... Wait, what was it again? Horseradish? Worcestershire? No, I remember now. A blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. Permitting himself a thin smile, Riker quietly spoke the rest. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are. He'd always considered this line one of the most underrated in English literature, but it resonated so much deeper now that his own restive nights had begun mirroring Ebenezer's. Following Liz's death, the notion of simply closing his eyes and falling peacefully asleep had become as foreign to him as the idea of starting his day refreshed and ready to face the world. This had never been more true than today. For sleep, which for the better part of a year had provided such scant refuge, now bestowed virtually none at all. At first, it had been the isolation and despair. Lying in bed, night after night, without his Lizzie lying next to him was the most soul-destroying pain Riker thought he could ever endure. It scraped him from the inside out, until he felt himself nothing but a hollow shell of what he had been and was meant to be. But then came the spots of light, the memories too often flitting from his grasp. And the headaches. Always the headaches. And always the same penetrating pain at the base of his skull that could just as easily have been someone ramming a crosshead screwdriver through the back of his head. Liz hadn't been gone even 6 months before the diagnosis. A 1-2 punch poised to destroy what little of his world remained. And in some ways, that was fine by Riker, because he had thought many times of just snuffing it out himself. Of course, he'd gotten on his knees and prayed first. Over and over. More times each day than he could count. Supplicating God for an act of benevolence he knew in his heart he did not deserve. Riker concentrated so intensely that sometimes the pain did lessen, at least in those meditative moments. But as soon as his mind returned to the stark reality that was now his life, the marble in his brain would glow again, grow again, forcing him to suffer in excruciating abandonment. Because his Lizzie was still gone, and she was never coming back. As the tumor satisfied its voracious hunger by devouring more and more of Riker's cerebellum, so the pain increased by equal measure. Finally, with his every prayer falling upon deaf ears, if there were any out there to hear him at all, Riker found himself trembling and pressed hard against the headboard of his Georgia Holmes bed, the barrel of the .38 in his mouth, as the sound of the cicadas and the toads serenaded the night. Now he had awakened in a grungy Hell's Kitchen rental, the soundtrack of New York City his only bedfellow, other than the incessant pain. He was here because something had stopped him from pulling that trigger, a thing so otherworldly and fantastical that the only word Riker could summon to even begin to describe it was angel. It came to him the following night as well, and 10 more nights after that. Each time it bestowed a little more of its unending wisdom, and each night it spoke of a chance at redemption, even hinting at the inconceivable possibility of Riker's return to the life he'd once known and would give anything to have back. So, Riker made his sojourn to New York, as was directed of him, whereupon the angel came a 13th and final time.
"Your calling is here, my lamb,"
it promised its chosen one, without speaking aloud, deep vibrations filling Riker's entire body until their warmth resonated from his toes to his nose.
"Your purpose will be fulfilled here, for here you will join the immortal, your name forever known as the Nexus of the New Apocrypha."
God may not have ears for Riker Winslow, but the angel did, and Riker was only too ready to implore its graces. Their nightly visits always started the same way. 3. Western Pennsylvania. The Dream. Riker is a child again, in the final days of the school year. It's that time when the boys' minds inevitably wander from dreary classrooms and final exams to a summer full of adventure. When that long-anticipated dismissal bell finally rings on the last day of school, its clanging peal officially announcing the start of summer, the children pour from the building in a human torrent. Sprinting through the hallways, they take the stairs 2 and 3 at a time, while woeful teachers look impotently on. As they burst, and not a moment too soon, through the school's main entrance doors, many delight themselves by sliding headlong down the metal railings along the concrete steps.
even though Nate Franklin Jr. had broken off a tooth last year in the most resplendent, blood-gushing fashion. They do this because, why not? In what is then acknowledged as the most glorious moment of the year, each boy steps onto that first mud-encrusted stair riser of school bus number 33, and into 3 months of glorious freedom. One small step for boy, one giant leap for boyhood. It's such a warm and carefree scene. Riker wants so badly to welcome its arrival each night, to bathe in the joy of the dream. But how can he, when he knows what comes next? With no segue, the dream smash cuts to the boy's annual march the next morning. The summer's first trek to the Little Woods. The march strides with purpose through the small figure-eight neighborhood, stopping at each boy's house along the way. This time, all but one is accounted for. Matt Chauncey does not answer, though they ring the bell and pound the door and rap on windows. Eventually, excited pleas for him to join them devolve into shouts of pussy, chicken shit, and wuss. At the bottom of the neighborhood, a field sprawls as far as the eye can see. Its surface undulates upon the welcomed breeze of this blazing summer morning, stalks of immature corn dancing and swaying in unified, almost hypnotic rhythms. This is the beginning of the wild place, and through it, two deep ruts from the passage of countless knobby tractor tires have formed a rough path. Riker follows this, bounding over small mud puddles and stopping here and there to investigate things he finds along the way. At the twin ponds, he drops to his knees and begins fishing through the murky waters. He turns over rocks with one hand while preparing to swoop in from behind with the other. Usually, this reveals nothing. But occasionally, there is a tiny beast like a wannabe lobster, and Riker is adept at grabbing these round the head, just behind the pincers where the crayfish cannot reach. They squirm and curl up their tails as the pincers open and close in the most threatening display. He often brings them close to his face, staring into their little black pin eyes as they snatch and click at his nose. Without warning, it is now the previous year. It's the moment Riker thrust a crayfish in the face of Craig Dalton. Craig is strolling ahead of him with Ian Cockerton and Jimmy. They're laughing at some joke the creepy Dalton kid just made about Farrah Fawcett, and how he has a faucet she could drink from, when Riker taps him on the shoulder. Still chuckling through a smile as broad as a wide-mouth frog, Craig turns to find a writhing swamp monster staring him in the face. He screams. Riker laughs and repeatedly jabs the crayfish closer as Craig winces and ducks. He prods the little beast too close, and the pincers find Dalton's cheek just beneath the eye. Craig screams as the tip of the crustacean's claw clamps down on the soft tissue, and a blood blister instantly colors the skin purple. Swatting at his face and stumbling over the tractor ruts and clumps of dirt, Dalton falls on his ass. The crayfish releases its grip and goes airborne, just missing Ian. It sails into Jimmy's hair and becomes entangled in the boy's thick curls.
What the? You friggin' douche nozzle!
Jimmy is clawing at his scalp, frantic and digging harder than the poor crayfish, which is dazed and merely trying to find purchase on something, as 8 spidery legs twist through his hair.
Jack, I'm gonna kill you!
Not if I kill you first,
Riker rebukes, tackling his younger brother as the crayfish is dislodged. It scuttles away through the weeds and puddles as Jack and Jimmy wrestle in the mud. Until the scene jumps like a bad 8mm film splice. It is now the next summer once more. Riker is again on his knees at the pond's edge. Again, he snatches an unwitting crayfish from beneath a rock. Ahead of him, Matt Chauncey, Ian Cockerton, and Craig Dalton are jostling and pushing one another as Dalton starts gushing over ABC's Tuesday night primetime lineup. He guffaws as he grabs the air ahead of him, rotating both open hands back and forth as if he's miming the testing of a pair of cantaloupes' ripeness. He's mentioned Suzanne Summers, something about her tits, then sniggering that he'd keep those babies company when Riker taps him on the shoulder. Dalton turns, still laughing, but screams when the wet pincer clacks at his face. This time he ducks and swats the creature from Riker's grip.
Get away from me!
Craig wipes a thin streak of pond water from his cheek, eyes glaring. He unconsciously runs his fingertips over the small scar in the soft tissue beneath his left eye.
Not this year, Jack, you fucktard.
Smash cut. Same dream. New scene. They're in a dark wood, standing beneath a colossal tree he knows is called the Father Oak. It dominates a cluster of lesser oaks, beech, and other trees, all of which form a rough perimeter around it. A meticulous arrangement of rocks and stones have been placed between these outlying trees, linking them together like a dotted line. The attentive work of generations of kids long before them, it highlights the circumference. At the center of the clearing is an oval of brushed dirt, where several logs lay parallel to one another, facing a carved tree stump close to the Father Oak. They are church pews before an altar. Brian Cockerton and another boy, who is both him and not him at the same time, are standing together near the stump, each taking turns to jump upon it and tower over the boys who watch with intense focus as the teams for their game of war are picked. The process is already underway when Riker joins it.
In that case, Brian declares as he steps into the oval clearing, snagging Jack's younger brother by the collar and all but dragging him to the stump. I'll take Jimmy.
Riker visibly winces. He knows he should have expected the retaliation, but contests the selection anyway.
Shit, you can't do that, Cockerton.
Sorry, big guy, no vetoes. You know the rules. All's fair in love and war, and all that jazz.
Riker needs to think. He pauses as he contemplates his next move. He carefully scans the faces. His younger brother Jimmy had been a big part of his plans. Time to adjust his strategy.
Fine, then Dan's with me.
Danny Mercer, aka Big Dan, is a mutual friend of them both. He's big, very big, but slow as syrup and twice as stupid. What he lacks in brain cells, he makes up for with muscle cells. And that strength is a bonus to whichever team he's on. Well worth his cerebral challenges. In short, no one messes with Big Dan.
Okay, then I'll have Woody. Take him. See if I give a shit, Bri. But while you're at it,
Riker smirks.
You can take the three douchketeers, too. All for one and one for all.
He gestures toward Brian Cockerton's brother, Ian, Creepy Craig, and Matt Chauncey.
Weird little Matt Chauncey, Riker thinks as the scene wavers like heat on a highway, a twisted grin beneath his mask of mud and red.
It is darker in the woods now, and he is holding the frightened boy's flute. As if on cue, Riker screams acrid breath into it. The cheap bamboo pipe shrills to inharmonious life, and from a limb of the Father Oak as thick as an elephant's leg, Stu Klatz takes this cue from his best friend. while Jack continues to pump sour notes from the flute. Stu retracts a muscled arm far behind his ear. He fires it blindly at Matt Chauncey's face. The fist is off target, but powerful as a piston, it makes little difference. It strikes with a popping sound, and Matt's nose spreads wide. Thin strands of red sling in all directions, weaving a concentric pattern across the drying mud which masks Matt's face. Spots Stu's shirtless torso like a bout of instantaneous measles. Chauncey cries out in a delayed, muffled cry as he cups a bloodied hand over his face. Stu revels in indifference as he artfully sweeps his leg around and perfectly executes a lightning-fast roundhouse kick. It happens so fast, it's impossible to dodge. Matt's legs sail out to the side and up. For a moment, his feet are level with his head before he crashes back down on the great branch of the father oak, and his ribs make a sickening cracking sound. The air bellows from his chest. His body goes slack and bends unnaturally around the curve of the branch. Then, Matt simply slides from the limb. Falling through the entanglement of offshoots and vines, he plummets towards the ground, screaming. One hand futilely clutches at empty air, the other for the loop around his neck. When the rope reaches its full extent, intense momentum jolts him violently back up. Matt's tongue darts from his mouth, and his own teeth cleave it clean in two. Blood sprays as the severed tip drops into the raging bonfire below. It sizzles in the flames, and the sound grows louder as the moisture within the tongue begins to boil, the tip instantly wizening. Above the flames, the boy continues to bungee up and down. With each cycle, the noose tightens even more. It constricts Matt's throat until the tongue boiling in the fire and the boy's choked-off scream become a single, snake-like hiss. It is this sound that fills Riker's ears until it is all he knows. Except now, it has become the sound of his wife's name through his own screaming lips.
Liz!
4. Blood Mountain, Georgia. 17 years before the end. October 1994.
Liz!
He shrieks as he attempts to pry her mangled left hand from the food processor. Having sliced off every finger, blades like serrated razors continue to devour them. Traveling from nail all the way to the metacarpophalangeal knuckle, the blades only stop when they finally embed in the bones of Liz's hand. Wrapped in a tight coil, the meat of her shredded muscle, tendons like rubber bands, and long strips of skin constrict the spindle. Amongst these is Liz's wedding band, the platinum still shining from the mound of pulverized flesh. The food processor's motor has begun to smoke, untenable levels of torque making it scream. It's the only thing that is. Liz is soundless, unmoving, staring straight ahead as though she sees something 1,000 yards beyond the subway tile backsplash just 2 feet in front of her.
Hang on, baby, hang on.
Liz shrugs. I'm fine. Riker reaches over the machine and pulls the plug. The iron stench of the blood is as prevalent as the spatter that's painted a conical spiral across the stove, backsplash, cabinet uppers, ceiling. His wife's torso, neck, and face.
I'm going to call 911, babe. I won't be. Don't move. I'll be.
He's already out of the kitchen and running for the living room handset. Plucking it from the wall, he pulls the chrome antenna so hard that it comes free in his hand. He checks the dial tone as panic begins to roil in his gut, the acid taste of bile rising to his chest and mixing with the iron.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?